now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah!
See, a United States astral robot becomes a creature of death.
Oh. And babes.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain. Back to the House of Pain.
Hello everyone and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast from classic cults and all the cheese in between. The movies are B, beer and entertainment is grade A. And I'm your host, Jason Giaconetti, and I am joined once again by my dad, Mr. Al Giaconetti.
Hey Jason, how are you? I guess we're going to be doing a hidden gem today, one of my favorite movies, The Abominable Snowman.
Yep, The Abominable Snowman, aka The Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas, and we'll get to it right after this.
A small band of men on a perilous search for the man-beast of Tibet. The abominable snowman of the Himalayas. You've heard of him, haven't you? The world's most shocking monster. No one's ever lived who's seen him. Be on your guard. He's coming to this theater. The abominable snowman dares you. We dare you. Dare you to see the abominable snowman of the Himalayas?
What did it look like? Tell me, what did you see, Kusang? Tell me!
I see what men must not see.
They're after me. They know it was me that did it last night. They're after me.
They're after all of us. They just killed McNee.
Why, sir? It was an accident.
It's me next. They know it was me.
Stay here.
Wait. Ed, I can hear you. I'm coming.
You've got to understand. That isn't Shelley. It isn't anybody.
I can hear his voice.
It's in your own mind. It's just happened to me, too.
Warning. Only those with stout nerves and strong hearts should risk seeing the abominable snowman of the Himalayas.
The Abominable Snowman was released August 26, 1957 in the UK with a running time of 91 minutes. It was directed by Val Guest. That's a name some of you might know if you're a Hammer fan, for all the quartermasts and the quartermasts in the pit and the enemy within. Written by Nigel Neal, and it's based on his TV play, The Creature, from 1955. The production company here was Hammer Films, distributed by Warner Brothers in the UK and 20th Century Fox here in the U.S. Again, it's also known by The Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas, which I think most people kind of, it's either title. The Abominable Snowman was the title, obviously, that most people have seen it, and that's what it was released on home video. It was also known for a little while as The Snow Creature. Now, The Snow Creature is also a 1954 movie, which is really not good, but they had to change it, obviously. So here we go. All right, so Dr. John Rollison, which is played by Peter Cushing, his wife Helen and his assistant Peter Fox are guests of the Lama on a monastery at Rungbuk while on a botanical expedition to the Himalayas. A second expedition led by Dr. Tom Friend. That's Forrest Tucker. Now, Forrest Tucker, you remember, was in The Crawling Eye, right? is accompanied by his trapper, Ed Shelley, a photographer, Andrew McNee, and Sherpa guide, Kurasang. They arrive at the monastery in search of the legendary Yeti, or Abominable Snowman. Rawlson, despite his objection of his wife and the llama, decide to join friend's expedition. Now, just stop there. So, we kind of covered a bunch at the beginning of the movie. And right. A lot of what they're doing there, and again, the beginning of the movie, this is not a creature feature. I mean, it's got the Abominable Snowman and, you know, kind of in the title, but this is certainly not a monster movie, and a lot of this is talking about the llama talking to them about the culture and different things, and like they're looking for medicines. He's a botanist. They're looking for medicines, and they start giving him the medicine. That's how it opens. Them trying to find glass jars to put the medicines in.
Right, all the
herbs and the stuff, herbs or you know, the things. So it's very clear from the get go that Cushing's character, which is Rawlson, he's really obviously there for medicine. He's there for scientific research, and he's there. And when and he's waiting on the other expedition, right? He doesn't even know those guys. They're coming. They're being sent. And that's where Tom Friend, which is Forrest Tucker, comes in. And I don't think you could have two more different characters than Rawlson and Friend, because they are completely opposites of each other. Rawlson is there for, you know, science. Friend will find out what he's really there for in the end, but he's here to kind of to find the Abominable Snowman.
Yeah, well, what I found that from the very beginning, it's a very atmospheric movie.
Yep.
The set designs set the tone for the entire movie, and that really gets you involved right away. Cushing, he brings professionalism to all his roles, but in this one especially, his believability, his intensity, and his passion for his work really, really sticks out. Forrest Tucker, Tom Friend, he seems sensible, but he's ambitious. And only later on, as the movie progresses, does his anxiety about not getting the Yeti in tow for his monetary gains,
right,
does it come out? But the interaction with all of the characters is believable as they set out on this trek.
Well, clearly you can tell there's some animosity there. The monks don't really want them there, the British,
right,
the people there in the first place, but they're willing to agree because they're trying to help medicine. You know, they're not trying to steal anything from them, but then clearly the llama is very upset that Friend is coming.
Yeah.
And he warns them about that. You know, that's the whole scene where he's warning them. Yeah.
Well, the llama, he's very prescient. Does he have an ulterior motive? I guess he doesn't want the expedition to succeed.
Yeah.
And it's, you can tell by the tone of his voice, but he's very, how would you put it? He's not demonstrative. He's very,
no, he's very,
as a matter of fact, you know, he's,
yeah. Well, he talks about things that would be, he's talked about their demise. And like, you know, like, well, this will not work, and you will die. Like, he's like, it's like, you're gonna die. Like, it's just so matter of factly to him, because he seems to be more enlightened about what's gonna happen, and we learn why that is. And he appears like in his trance-like states and things like that. It would go. So again, Rawlson's wife does not want him going because he used to be a great climber, but he had the accident and he doesn't think he can climb anymore. So and we very clearly see. Obviously the llama as well doesn't want to, but, Rawlson decides to join Friend's expedition, where clearly Rawlson's motivated by scientific curiosity to learn more about what's happening, and he is interested in the creature. I think that's what's going for. He definitely wants to go find the plant life and stuff, the medicines, but he really wants to find the creature as well. But it's like he's not going to sacrifice what his goal was and what the university sent. That's right. The university sent me here to do this. He's going to do his job. But hey, if we're going to go anyway, we can find the Yeti anyway. Whereas Friend is like, I don't care what happens. He wants fame and fortune. He'll do what he needs to do because he reminds me of Carl Denham. Carl Denham's like, look, we got gas bombs, we can get them. Like, and I don't necessarily mean Denham from 33. Think more like Jack Black, kind of like in the remake. Like, he's like, whoa, he's not that he's kind of, we can totally do this. Like, he's willing to go and put people's lives in danger. Not even necessarily meaning to. Friend is much worse, I think, at the end of the day.
At the end of the day, yeah. but Friend is willing to put his life on the line, too.
Well, Denham puts his life on the line.
Yeah, but again, what I found here was that the dialogue that goes on between all of the particular people here on both Cushing side and on Tucker's side, it's consistent and relevant to the story.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's not that off topic. I'm just saying it.
I mean, the only thing that the sanity here is the wife's premonition of doom really adds to the mystery.
Right. So, all right, so the expedition climbs high into the mountains and they find a set of giant footprints in the snow, and then they find that to be evidence of the Yeti's existence. Even before we get to that, I love that they're getting up there and there's, again, the monks are, there's no violence, nothing, but yet there's a bunch of them they send out with a gun and they try to kill them and they shoot back at them. And I'm like, it seems a little, not that it's out of place because it makes sense, but it's like, the problem is when they look back at them, they're just standing there holding the gun. And then they shoot at them and they like run away. So,
well, but you know what? There is even scene like that.
It just seemed like they didn't need that to be there. I understand why.
Well,
it's there.
But they may not needed it. They may not have needed them to shoot at them.
Yeah.
But they were following them.
They were tracking them.
They were tracking them. But I must say this about the movie: the scenes of the men climbing, it works seamlessly with the live actors' interaction.
Yeah.
And the studio shots. I mean, there's a lot of times where you can tell when you have a studio shot and you have the background, and there's five climbers and Poussin, the guy, and the clothes they're wearing, they almost. I said this to when I was watching this. I said, that looks like the five guys wearing the same clothes.
What I'm saying is they got the stock footage and they matched
and
up.
They matched
but
it
I
up.
Think what helps this movie more than anything else is the fact that it's black and white. Right?
Right.
Because Hammer had made Curse of Frankenstein around this time and it's in full color and the whole... This movie is helped by the black and white. I think the black and white here helps lend some of that because there's so much snow and there's so much... It helps kind of your eye be, you know... Even if they're not exactly the same uniforms, they're dark enough. Your eye can pick up just enough that it's the same color to it.
Yeah, and also you can tell because even the backpacks look the same.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, that adds a lot. Yeah. If you know, when you watch something, I'm a very, very big continuity guy, and when you have something that is obviously not related to what they're trying to tell you, it just ticks me off.
Yeah.
But this one here, it just keeps your interest all the way through. You're not thinking of something else. You're just wondering what's going to come next.
Yeah. All right, so as there's tension, obviously, between Rollison and Friend when they kind of now come to butt heads about why they're on this mission, and Friend made it very clear that he is there for profit gain instead of scientific knowledge, and he wants to be the man who has found the Yeti. He wants that fame and notoriety that goes with that. And that's about the time when McNee steps in the bear trap, which is the best is the sound. Now, again, it might be a stock sound they just did in studio, where he takes the ice pick and he's hitting the metal of the bear trap. That sound, it sounds almost exactly like when they're hammering a stake into a Dracula, or not right. Dracula, but into any of the brides. That thrap sound, that like, you know, kind of thing, that sharp hit, it's almost exactly like the hammer sound later. Now, again, it might be a stock sound they used. It might, again, they're in the same studio doing whatever, but it just takes you there. Having, again, watching this out of order. Dracula hadn't happened yet. You didn't have all the Dracula movies and where this stuff would happen. But
when McNee, he steps into the bear trap.
Yeah.
Now he's, not that he's crippled, but he's
it's
been...
It's made his foot useless.
I mean, so they put him in a tent.
Yeah.
And now we're 50 minutes into the movie when he's in the tent.
Well, the thing with McNee also, too, is, let's just point this out, McNee pays Friend to go along.
Yeah,
because he wants to redeem himself. He saw a Yeti but never did anything. Like, he feels his entire existence is now him trying to redeem himself. And that, I think, is important to his character because he's not an expert climber. In fact, he's the worst climber.
Right.
He's slowing them down. He's doing things that, you know, like even Cushing jokes about it. Well, you're not gonna get me killed, are you? Kind of thing. Like, you know, like, again, he's the clearly the weak link, and I think that's exploited. What you're getting at right now is down the tent. The Yeti, you know, they capture what is that snow monkey, right? I'm thinking that might be. They said it's a snow monkey, right? I'm thinking that might have been a child, like one of the Yeti children.
But again, it looked like a monkey.
Well, they don't show you it.
Well,
they imply it,
yeah.
Right? But when they showed the footprints, there's clearly a very small footprint, and there's a very big footprint that looked very, very similar. So, again, you can believe it's the monkey, you can believe it's not the monkey, whatever. When the Bigfoot shows up, when the Yeti shows up, not Bigfoot, the Yeti shows up, that's the wrong part of the country, and it puts its hand under
right,
into the tent, and it's reaching around, touching the gun, the hand is what it is. I mean, it's you know, it's clearly a puppeted hand. I mean, it's whatever. But I think that's when they show that McNee is susceptible to the because he goes into that trance-like state. You know,
that confrontation, that again, it's 50 minutes in. All they've done is talk about him. You haven't seen anything. You've seen
a footprint.
And again, we've seen many footprints by many different creatures over time. But usually you've seen the creature long, long before this. But that confrontation at that point, I call it reared its ugly head. The Yeti puts his hand under the tent and McNee is there. And now it's almost like the same reaction that you had when the in the original Boris Karloff's Mummy, where you see his shadow come across the table
in the beginning.
And that element of fear comes across the archaeologist's face, and it's just a very effective scene. I mean, you don't need to see a monster come through to scare you. The hand itself is the link,
right? So after that, that's when Kersang comes in, sees it, and he flees. He runs down the mountain. Right. It'll take him a day. He runs for a day straight down the mountain to get back to that, and he tells Helen, you know, the wife, and Fox that they, you know, that they've seen a Yeti, and they take him away. That's the best. She sees him, and then they like kind of grab him and they hustle him off.
Well, but
that's when she goes into the basement and she gets jumped by the servant, right?
But Pusang. It went when the wife and Fox when they grab him, they ask him, you know, what's happened. His only words in English is, "I see what man must not see."
Right. Yeah.
And then he's whisked away by the llama's like the coolies there or whatever that they are.
Yeah. So while that's happening, Shelley succeeds in shooting and killing a Yeti, and they shoot him down. Now, this is the scene where I think everyone. Maybe this is the current way of thinking. Like, okay, I'm looking at this going, okay, if I'm looking at this movie in 1950, you know, seven, I'm thinking, all right, now I'm going to see this thing. And they still don't show it to you. They show you the hand, the same hand they used before, and they talk about how big it is. And it's over 10 feet. And it says, and they're just describing it, and they keep describing it. I think what we're seeing a lot of here is again harkening back to the 1955 TV play The Creature. I think they're using a lot of that same idea here, is talking more about it, you know, kind of show, instead, because they couldn't show you, didn't have the budget. And saying in the TV movie, no way they had the budget for it, so they talk more about it. So I think they're keeping true to that, but by keeping it just out of your vision. Like, it's like, I look at it this way, and everyone's done this. When you're trying to watch something on TV, you can't see it, and you kind of move your head. Not that there's anything in your way, but you're trying to look around the physical object on the screen. It doesn't happen. You feel like you want to kind of like peek. Like, if I lean forward a little bit, maybe I can see this Yeti. Maybe I can see what they're talking about. Now, he shot and killed it. There's blood in the snow. There's footprints. There's the hand. Clearly, it's heavy because they kind of move it. It takes three of them to move the sled, you know. So, obviously, they kill the Yeti. And that's when the other Yetis start calling, right? And they realize there are more Yetis. And that's when McNee becomes trance after he's put that white, it looks like plaster of Paris. It must be whatever he's trying to fix his foot. Cushing's trying to fix his foot. He becomes entranced again and tries to climb the mountain and then winds up falling to his death, right? And what happens, the first thing Friend says, they killed him. Right. Yeah, he fell, and then Cushing said, no, he fell because his foot was useless. No, they killed him. And he's very adamant that it is truly the Yeti, in whatever magical, mystical powers they have now taken control of him and killed him. And he's paranoid. I mean, Friend is very paranoid before it even gets to the part where he becomes paranoid about what's happening. So, they kill it. Okay, so this, obviously, now the other creatures are really mad, right? And they're going to come get it. So... they set up the trap in the cave, right? With the steel net.
Steel net
Before they get to that's when they come and they have the encounter in the cave. When Shelley is there and he's in the cave and he finally encounters the other two and he can't even describe what it is. He's seen them now. He's seen Yetis now alive, and he says the look on their eyes is so like different. That's when they set up the trap in the cave, which I think speaks 100% to Friend's entire motivation in the movie. He gives him blanks.
Yeah, he gives him a blank. He gives him a blank gun.
A magazine with blanks, like, right? So he, and even if he had fired and shot, he wouldn't have killed him. And they tear. He knows they're going to wind up. I mean, he's hoping the steel net will trap the live Yeti, but it already took the bear trap and tore it to shreds. You know it's not going to catch him. So what you're kind of hoping for is that maybe this works. Maybe you get there. You know, if he had thought ahead, he'd have gas bombs. But he didn't have gas bombs, you know, to knock him out. Then I think they have a gun.
Yeah, but what he says later on, when he's approached by that, Ed wasn't killed by the Yeti, and he didn't have a heart attack, which is what Friend said. He was frightened to death.
Yeah.
And, you know, Friend screws him by not loading the gun, the rifle, with live ammo, because he didn't want another dead one.
Right,
he wanted a live one.
Yeah.
And so that's where now Friend is now. He's gone off the deep end. Yeah. It's now, you know, he wants the money, the fame, the fortune, and regardless.
Right.
And he wasn't taking any chances.
See, at this point, he makes a good point there, too. And he's like, well, why couldn't you just be satisfied with the dead one? So they could put it in a jar and pickle it and study it forever? Right. I need something. But instead of having the ability to be, look, we have a dead one. This is a Yeti. We're showing you what a Yeti is and becoming the man who didn't necessarily captured one. Because then someone else would have gone back and captured a live one. And it wouldn't have been him. And he talks about the wolf children or whatever they, you right. know. He's a shyster. Still underneath it all, he's still trying to make a buck. And he took children who had mental disabilities and stuff and dressed them up to be these wolf
like
children.
Wolf boys,
right? Kind of thing. And Cushing calls him out on it. Mm-hmm. I think that also, you notice the similarity there to what they're talking about in The Crawling Eye, where Forrest Tucker's character there knows about what happened in that other place
right.
with the mist, and they don't believe him. It's funny. And again, you know, they're actors, and they have to replace people in movies and whatever, but it seems like some guys play the same role. And I'm not saying he's like that in The Crawling Eye, but he kind of has that, like, ulterior motive. I'm trying to, like, clear my name, like, I need to whatever kind of thing. It's not the same, but there's similarities to his characters. And here, he clearly is motivated by money. There, he wants to get his reputation and not, you know, he wants to become, you know, whatever, you know, kind of thing. He's a scientist and he's trying to prove something.
Yeah, and this is at this point, now the paranoia is really starting to set
yeah,
in.
Yeah, yeah.
Both of them are now hearing
voices.
The radio is playing.
Even though it's smashed,
And Friend is hearing Ed calling him and saying, come on, help me.
They just buried him in the snow, yeah.
Right.
So,
and
well, that's the line. What do you need a spade for? Oh yeah, McNee. And it's just so like he's so much garbage. Like he couldn't even be, you know,
right.
deal with it.
And Friend then as he's listening to Ed call, he goes, "Where are you? Where are you?" And he starts shooting off his gun, and it creates an avalanche, which then kills him.
Yeah.
And I mean that was in a way that was poetic justice.
Yeah, so Rawlinson, you know, after the avalanche, takes refuge in an ice cave and watches in amazement as a number of Yetis arrive and take away the body of the dead one, right? And I think that's one of the things, and that's the scene where you're like, okay, I'm finally going to see a Yeti. What do they show you? This hulking mass, it's kind of hairy, it's definitely big, and they show you the eyes. They only show you the eyes.
Yeah, the face.
Yeah. Well, they don't show you the whole face. It's just the eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't even see the whole rest of the whole face.
Well, like they said, it looked like sadness and wisdom.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what it was. Like they were, you know, they were sad of that their brethren was dead.
Killed, yeah.
But there was sadness. But there was wisdom also in that. You know, it's hard to put.
Well, no, I think it's this. I mean, clearly this. They have the ability to control those who want to be controlled. Right. McNee was again at this point was kind of. They were able to control his mind enough for him to climb up and kill himself. I mean, he didn't want to kill himself.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I wonder if that was from the paranoia. I don't believe that the extraterrestrial
right, but
powers.
But clearly, the llama is able to connect with them.
Right.
The llama goes into a trance. He's talking to the Yeti or communicating. I shouldn't say talking with. He's communicating with. He might be being you know told what to do. It makes what it really sets up. At least to me, it was the idea that the Yeti run the show. And we're just, you know, part of it. And that, and the Cushing talks about that, the evolutionary step between the great apes and man, that maybe this is another evolution, and that no, it's not ape, and no, it's not man. Yeah. Maybe it's the higher being waiting until man kills themselves off to come out of hiding.
Yeah.
And I think what that's why, and again, if you go into this movie going, man, I hope I see a Yeti killing people, there are plenty of movies with Bigfoot and Yetis that are made recently, which are nothing but just a guy in a suit or really bad CGI killing people. This is ultimately the story of individuals and what they, and everyone has a motive, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, of what they're doing and why they're doing it. Why is the llama telling him not to go? Because the llama is trying to protect. He's there basically to protect the Yeti. I don't, whether that's the llama's doing, whether that's the Yeti talking to him, whether that's part of their culture, whether that might be, it ultimately is him saying is, no, don't go there. There's nothing but death. There's nothing. It will not end well.
Yeah, I found that Yeti reveal at the end of just the upper part of the face was an outstanding visual, and it was very satisfying to me. Rather than having the Yeti come in and take Peter Cushing and slash him all over the wall, and the
well, but I think also too that the Yeti at that point, remember, who's the Yeti kill? They kill McNee. Right, they start, you know, howling, and he kills him. So he drops off the thing because they killed one of theirs. We kill one of yours back, you know, kind of thing. It kills Ed, right, Shirley, right? Because again, he's trying to kill them, so they're killing. You know, they're in self defense, and Tucker goes crazy, friend goes crazy and kills himself. So, but why would they kill man who's learned? Right. Like, I think they understand.
Oh, no,
I
agree with
that. I think that's why they don't kill
him.
I don't think they
physically killed anybody. They drove.
Yes, they drove them insane to
insane.
Kill them. It's okay. That's like saying technically the rocks don't kill anybody, or the sirens don't kill anybody in Seven Voyages of Sinbad. It's the rocks that do it.
Right. Yeah,
right. Okay. But who's going? Ooh! And they slam into the rocks. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But they are leading that way. And I think what they feel is that Cushing is learned and someone who they, you know, is understanding of them. And what do? They make he blacks out.
Right.
And then they find him. And then I think at the end when they're in when the llama's questioning him, he goes, "No, we found nothing.
Nothing. We found nothing."
And you can see in the llama that like he understands that is the that he, this is now. It's there's no way that Cushing could now start speaking about like, oh yeah, we found this, because no one is going to then say, okay, this is clearly somebody who has, you know, like,
right.
You know, he has no proof, right? And what's it going to accomplish? More people are going to be brought up there and be killed. It's better to leave it alone.
Leave it alone.
Because he has his medicines. He will be successful at what he's doing, and he escaped with his life. You don't, here's the old thing. You don't spit in the wind. You don't pull on Superman's cape. You know, kind of. You don't tempt things that often.
Yeah. And the parting line of the llama is that, that's right. There is no Yeti.
Yeah.
And that's how the movie ends.
Yeah. And again, this Peter Cushing did 22 Hammer movies. This is his first, right?
This is the first one. I didn't realize.
Because technically, okay, Curse of Frankenstein was shot after this.
Yeah.
Okay. And Curse of Frank, even though they're around the same time, when this hit, this was released in the UK first. When it came to the US, it took a couple of years to get here to the US. Curse of Frankenstein didn't take a long time. It hit and then it hit. That's why it got lost, and that's what people always say. The Curse of Frankenstein kind of like buried this movie. Curse of Frankenstein was made, and then it came to the US at about the same time as this. This, of course, was in England long before. Remember, and this is. Peter Cushing actually played the role of John Rawlinson in the BBC Sunday Night Theater version of this movie called The Creature. And then Forrest Tucker actually had to replace a man named Stanley Baker, who's a big name
British actor,
right? And because they couldn't get him. And then like the Quartermass movies, right? This was produced, and the Quartermass movie, I'm talking about Quartermass Experiment, 55, Enemy from Space, 57, and 50 Million Years to Earth in 67. It was based on the same... Nigel Neal, it's all his plays, right? They're all his TV plays. Well, they were all the same thing. They were the BBC Sunday night theater movie. And so they knew what they were doing. And again, Nigel Neal, this I know him from his Hammer, the stuff that he created for Hammer, but think of it like Richard Matheson. Richard Matheson did a lot of TV stuff. And people know, they're like, oh, that guy? Like, when you watch Twilight Zone episodes, there are Rod Serling episodes, and you know the Rod Serling episodes, but you also remember the Richard Matheson episodes, Nightmare 20,000 Feet, things like that. He wrote ones you're like, oh man, that one? If it's really good, it either has Rod Serling or Richard Matheson's name attached to it, because they knew what they were doing for that. And I think that's one of the reasons what Hammer knew what they had, again, making Neil's television drama into these movies, because they knew there was good writing there. It was a good story, and that's really the big thing behind it. Now, in 2013, it was announced that Matthew Reed and John Croker were scripting a modern take on this for the new Hammer Films company that just opened. Hammer Films just came back, and they're taking a modern take on this. My problem with that is we've seen modern takes on Yeti and Bigfoot, and they're just... they're schlock. I mean, that's what they are. There's not... I can't imagine this would be anything nearly as about the relationship between people and their struggle instead of just a monster movie. This was actually the only Hammer film produced by Aubrey Baring, and the last one in association with a man named Robert L. Lippert. Now, Misty fans will remember Robert L. Lippert from King Dinosaur, along with other ones. Lippert, again, went on to make other movies, obviously. Now, this movie was double featured with The Crawling Eye. And it makes perfect sense that it was double featured with The Crawling Eye. Yeah. Forrest Tucker's in both of them. Makes perfect sense. They have a lot in common. The atmosphere. I think the main difference is The Crawling Eye at the end becomes a monster movie. And this at the end still stays a drama.
Yeah, and that's probably why it's become lost. You don't find movies like this that are very, very popular with an awful lot of people, and that you don't even see this on even on TCM. Every once in a while, for their Halloween 30 days or 31 days of Halloween, you'll rarely see this one there because it's not a monster movie.
This comes up when they're talking about it, like they'll do, like tonight we're focusing on, and it's something specific that movie might have.
Well, this one, the reason I saw this one again a while ago was that it was a Peter Cushing retrospective.
Yes.
And believe it or not, Peter Cushing when you think of him, you think of him as Van Helsing and movies like this.
And Frankenstein.
But he had a huge plethora of movies that he was involved in, from comedy to drama to horror.
Yeah. And then eventually, the whole other generation knows him as Grand Moff Tarkin. You know, it's just so funny because he's like, to me, having, you know, growing up, and again, Star Wars, I mean, I like Star Wars, but it's not like the end all and be all of who I am. I look at Peter Cushing there, I'm like, oh man, it's Peter Cushing. People are like, Grand Moff Tarkin. And I'm like, okay, but like, that's Peter Cushing. That's Van Helsing. That's the Baron. Because to me, his best roles were, and he was great as Van Helsing. He was great as Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes stuff is killing. In fact, his Hound of the Baskervilles might be the best version. It might be better than Basil Rathbone's version. But as Frankenstein, as the Doctor, he is the best Frankenstein ever, because he doesn't what am I doing? I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm just creating life where death was there. I'm trying to save people and help them.
Yeah, I had said that. I had said this very early in this review. His acting is believable, it's intense, and he brings a passion to each role. He just doesn't mail it in.
Yeah. So, one of the things I just want to point out here, so this was released August 26, 1957, with an A certification from the British Board of Censors, which means it's not a Cert X.
Right.
We talked about that a little bit. And it was double billed with Untamed Youth, the Mimi Van Doren movie.
Uh-huh.
Now, another Misty reference, because Untamed Youth, Luke loves that one. It's a very funny Misty. Most people kind of, because it's not one of their more famous ones, right? And, you know, but it's kind of funny that it's, Untamed Youth. Could there be any more different a thing? When it comes to the U.S., they put it with The Crawling Eye, which makes way more sense.
Right.
But again, it's just what it was. They double featured that. And the Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas, that title was only used in the U.S. It was never called that over there. It was originally called the Snow Creature, which, of course, they changed. And they called it the Abominable Snowman. Now, the problem is, I'm betting a lot of people may have seen this when they were younger. If you're a little older, kind of thing. Like Luke and I saw it when we were younger, but then again, we have kind of a different... We saw a lot of movies that most people didn't ever even know existed when we were younger. The problem is, getting to see this movie is hard. We were just looking for it. I mean, my dad has a copy. It's part of the Hammer collection, and he bought that when it came out on DVD. But we looked it up on Amazon. What did we say it was?
Like $77.
Almost $80. It was $80 for a single DVD. Now you're thinking, Jay, maybe there's a set of it. Oh, you can get it with the movie called Shatter for $85. Like,
a dollar.
Shatter is not worth $5 more. I'm sorry, but and even it's basically $1 per minute.
Right, $1 a minute.
Yeah,
it's only because of its rarity.
Yeah,
and that's
because
it's not that popular.
Well, I think what's going to happen, and we've seen this now recently. At the end of 2016, we saw this. A bunch of Hammer movies started coming out, and I'm not talking big ones because trust me, if they would just put out The Horror of Dracula, finally in the U.S. on DVD on Blu-ray, because they had the old DVD. They put the Blu-ray out that has all the special features they had over in England. It would sell. I know that people were, Blu-ray's dead, whatever. Well, if you can't get it, you're going to buy it and how it comes out. Okay? Everyone thinks everything's dead until they put it out and like, oh, wow, this sold really well. The Abominable Snowman is one of the ones that's lost. Curse of Frankenstein's not available on Blu-ray yet. Now, there's that TCM put out that Curse of Frankenstein, Horror of Dracula, Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed, and I don't remember the other Dracula movie. I think it might be Blood of Dracula or something.
It wasn't
Prince of Darkness. That would have made sense to be Prince of Darkness, but it wasn't. Those came out, and that was on DVD a few years ago, and that's fine. But they just came out with was The Mummy. It was a couple of Frankenstein, but it was a Blu-ray set. And then they came out the Blu-ray set of other things, like it was the one where they put out Beast from 20,000 Fathoms or whatever. Those kind of things coming out need to sell. Now, I'm not telling you need to go buy these things. But again, when you don't support things, this came up the other day. Someone said, hey, does anyone have a link to go watch Shin Godzilla online for free? And they're like, you're not being very supportive if you do that. Like, I'm watching the movie. That's supportive. No. Pirating the movie is not supporting anybody. The only way we're going to see these movies come out again is if we're being supportive and being vocal. When they ask, I've been part of Shout Factory and Scream Factory and you name it. They say, what movies do you want to see? These movies. And then somebody like, well, we can't get those movies. Or, hey, that's not a real movie, buddy. You know, kind of thing. Yeah. You're like, I want to see a movie where Wonder Woman fights Wolverine. That's not real. So, the whole point is, like, being supportive of these and looking into, like, these lost classics. Now, this is not on YouTube. I looked around. Maybe sometimes a movie that's out of print, YouTube will have a copy of it floating in and won't say. You can't, like, now Crawling Eye is on YouTube. And the Crawling Eye can still be had for like $15 or whatever on DVD, but and it's like an older print. But this thing, I couldn't find it anywhere. I mean, I looked on eBay, I looked online. There's nowhere it's streaming. It's just have to go out of your way to find this movie.
I mean, when we go to the shows, there are guys who are selling thousands of DVDs, and this one is not part of it. It's never there. You never see it. Now, it could be because they know that it's so rare that if they put a price on it that's too high, people are just gonna let it go.
Yeah.
But if you ever get a chance to see this, especially if you get a chance on TCM without commercials.
Yeah,
because if you see it with commercials, it'll ruin it because all the tension goes away.
Yeah.
I mean, I've said this many times. There are times during the day I'll turn on AMC and they'll have on a really good movie. And you get to a tense moment, the next thing you know is they're selling, Geico motor insurance.
Right,
and so you lose it.
Yeah.
There is one thing I wanted to do. This movie is a British movie. And a typical British scene in this movie, and it's one that really tickled me a little bit. When Poussin comes back and says that he's seen the Yeti, and Fox and the wife get the some of the bears to go out and go look
for them
again. What is the first thing that Fox does? He puts his tie on.
Yeah.
I mean, if that isn't British, nothing is. I mean, you're going out, you got to put your tie on?
Well, it's very important to look good, Dad, on the mountain, so you don't want to, come down. Anyway, so, like I said, folks, this was a movie you should go, spend the time, check it out. If you get a chance to see it, it's great. It's well worth spending an hour and a half watching. It's not schlock. You're not gonna laugh through this. In fact, I don't think there's any real humor. This is played straight, and I think that's part of the problem too, is that since it's played completely straight and there's no giant monster, it kind of got lost in the 1957 has a lot of giant monsters in it. This is not one of those giant monsters. I mean, 57, we're talking summer of 57. If you add this, you have the giant, Black Scorpion. You got 20 million miles to Earth. You got, 57 was a packed year.
I mean, this reminds me, because of the, not so much the subject matter, but because of the story, it's a little like in the same year that the Incredible Shrinking Man came out. I mean, there's
Richard Matheson's story about that.
There's a spider at the end, but again, it's not a monster.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point,
The cat tries to kill him.
Right.
I mean, a drop of water becomes his enemy.
It's enemy.
And that movie is so... But The Incredible Shrinking Man is, remember... Again, also, The Incredible Shrinking Man is an American movie. So it was, you know, readily available. But that's remembered for all those things. And because it's why. It's him losing himself as he goes. And it's him shrinking and him feeling as less of a man. And I think that's what that... Matheson captures here.
Yeah,
here is a lot more of men going insane.
Yeah. And again, it's that's what I'm saying. Is that if you can watch a movie for its value, for what it's portraying, that's what makes it a successful picture.
Yeah. So, all right, folks. So, obviously, we are getting here into the new year, 2017, kicking this off. My dad and I have been looking at what we're going to do this year. Again, we last year we were able to put out 13 episodes. We're hoping to get 13 this year too. The number might be more than 13. I mean, we want to do a special. I mean, we like doing a Christmas special. I don't know if you all love Santa's Sleigh, but Santa's Sleigh is really funny. Could there be any more two different movies than Santa's Sleigh and The Abominable Snowman? I'm just saying, it's pretty different. So what were we looking at next? Well, obviously, we get to February. People think of February, it's cold. But I think of February being about love. About Valentine's Day. How about... I Married a Monster from Outer Space. Yes, that is the movie we are doing. Yes, folks, we are going to be the love doctors. They're going to be in the building for the Boss, Bugs, and Babies in February. So, anything else, Dad? I think we've covered this. Yeah, we're good. I Married a Monster from Outer Space is fine. It's good. I mean, he's got an ugly mug on him. I'll tell you that right now. So
he makes a good model, though. That's for sure.
Oh, it's a fantastic model. But we'll talk about all that in February. So join us in about a month, folks, to hear more about that. If you have any comments, questions, maybe you've never seen this movie and you get to see it and you want to take, hey, I love this movie, write in, let us know, botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. We'd love to hear about it. Again, anything else, folks, you want, if you have suggestions, whatever, anything we're doing, maybe we left something out, you're like, hey, this actor did this and he was in this movie, whatever, let us know, because your feedback helps us get better. So keep those cards and letters coming and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots, Bugs, Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment.
So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow. There is no tomorrow. There is no tomorrow.
Will you stop?